This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, and I have been waiting with bated breath for this next segment. For all intensive purposes, our next guest is an expert on language. His latest book is an exfoliation on the way we misuse words, which is polemical if we want to truly underestimate what people are saying. But he doesn't pretend to be a language purist, so let's just nip that in the butt right now. I'm talking, of course, about malapropisms. They drive some of us crazy. You can stop sending that email now, by the way. Those of you who are typing the email, to stop, because I knew what I did. He's an English professor, Robert Rubin. These are actually a source of amusement for him, for those of us who get crazy over them. He loves them, and they're really examples of how language evolves. Robert Rubin teaches at Meredith College in Raleigh. He's written a book called Going to Hell in a Hen Basket, an illustrated dictionary of modern malapropisms, in which he explores the newest ways in which we misuse words and phrases. And if you have your own malapropism that you would like to share, or you have a question for Robert Rubin, you can call us at 877-962-9862. You can send us an email, sot@wunc.org, or a tweet at #malaprop. And Robert, even though this is a soft tissue, we're really a cartilage to have you.
Well, I'm more than happy to be here.
That was, by the way, that was both a pun and I believe a malapropism.
Okay.
In one. I think I'm proud, proud of that moment.
As a lover of puns, that's how I got into it in the first place. So.
But really, when I say that, I mean, as a soft tissue, you know, it's a cartilage to have you. Really, none of those was, I guess, cartilage, possibly a malapropism. But this is our cue to ask you, what is a malapropism?
Well, it's basically just a mistake in language, getting one word mixed up for another, or inventing a new word that you think makes sense, but that actually makes perfect nonsense.
Yeah. Give us an example right off the bat.
Oh, I don't know. I was at my mother's retirement center the other day, and the waitress came up to offer us the menu, and she said, "Today we have fried chicken with a vegetable melody."
There you go, with a song in her heart. Well, that's kind of great. But that's the sort of thing.
Sure.
You take medley and the part about that helps make a malapropism is it kind of makes sense, right?
Yes, and well, there some of them kind of make sense. These are a species of malapropisms called eggcorns that do make sense when you think about them. But a lot of malapropisms don't make sense. The original ones, like those Shakespeare used, were just the wrong words.
Yeah. And well, and he was very deliberate in some of them. In fact, one of your favorite characters in Shakespeare is famous for his malapropisms,
sure.
Right?
Sure. Dogberry, the constable in Much Ado About Nothing. Another word for malapropisms is dogberryisms.
Wow.
And he was somebody who was trying to be a social climber, of course. He was trying to move up, and so he was using fancy vocabulary that he didn't understand. And Shakespeare was having a lot of fun with that.
How have you organized the entries in this book? Tell us about how you put it together.
I intended this to be a dictionary, just sort of A to Z, alphabetized basically by the malapropism. There are about 600 of them, and it basically just... I don't know. It's organized the way a dictionary would be, but yeah. The funny part about it, I hope, is the sort of story of the language behind the malapropism. I mean, a lot of these words are out there on the internet to be discovered, and what's interesting is once you've discovered them, is to figure out why they were made and why the mistake happened. And
well, and how they and whether or not, because I have to say, when I went through this, I had not heard anybody really use some of them. Some of them are spelling errors. You know, like if you say the baby was bawling and you spell it B-A-L-L and B instead of B-A-W-L, it suggests you don't know what it is, although maybe we could stop right there and tell us what we really mean when we say bawling and where that word comes from and why we might mistake it for a ball.
Well, for instance, the expression bawl your eyes out or something like that. We mean it to mean crying. Somebody is crying. The original B-A-W-L is English, and it referred to animal noises. And for some reason, Americans have taken it to mean crying, I guess, like an animal.
Well, sure. But you can see how the comparison would be made.
Sure.
You're bawling like a sheep or something and then misspell it.
But the original context gets lost, and so it might as well just be balls because you have eyeballs, right?
Yeah.
And
bawling your eyes out.
Bawling your eyes out. Yeah. So.
Well, another one is on the lam.
Okay.
Tell us about it.
Well, most people don't know that that expression comes from hitting things. If you talk about, you've heard the expression lambaste, that's the same word. And it's if you lam something, you're hitting it, you're beating it. And so you've heard the expression, beat it, it's the cops. Well, we're on the lam. But a lot of people think it's the lam.
Yeah, which makes no sense. I mean, that would make no sense. Like, if you're trying to get away, what would you be doing on a lam?
Right. Well, I did some illustrations for the book, and I drew my my mascot for the book, which is a chicken, riding a lam with the cops chasing it.
So, yeah. But it makes sense, too, because, again, when you think about it, it's a German word, I think, lam, derived from the word that means to beat. And so if you – I mean, we say this, right, because we drive mostly. If you want somebody to hurry up, you say step on it, referring right. to the gas pedal. But if you were riding a horse, you would say beat it. You'd beat the horse, and that would go faster. So you can get how the context was created, and then it just goes kaflooey.
Well, we forget the history of words. I mean, I think that's one of the things that one of the reasons why I call these modern malapropisms, because we just use them and we hear them on the radio or on TV, and they make sense to our ears. And then when we write them, we don't know how to spell them. And in a lot of cases, we shoot a note to our friend. Now, in the old days, nobody would see that note, but now it gets on the internet, it gets tweeted, and so I could go out in researching this book and find all these wonderful tweets and misspellings and things like that that are passed along from person to person. And it's just a delight to sort of explore the way people mishear and misuse language. And I do too. I'm not a purist on this. I'm certainly somebody who's made plenty of mistakes in language in his life.
Yeah. Well, it's clearly in the age of the internet, it's hard to keep your mistakes indivisible. Because God forgive it should ever happen here. But this is the sort of thing, and it gets out there in the big wide world, and it kind of makes sense. And some of the ones, I guess, that go on, but it is most surprising to me the ones that don't make sense, and yet they get transmitted. Right.
Right. Well, I mean, when you think about it, one of my pet peeves is when people say, well, let's hone in on the subject. Mm. And that really doesn't make sense. It's you hone a knife, you sharpen it.
Right.
But do you sharpen in on a subject? No, you home in on it like a homing pigeon, right? But it's actually hone in on has become so accepted that it's in a lot of major dictionaries now.
Wow.
And so it's becoming perfectly acceptable to use it.
That's one of my pet peeves, too. So Hell in a Handbasket, I think we've been talking about that one. Tell us about it.
Well, it's one of these phrases that people just used because it sounded good, the H's. Shakespeare has a great history of he says, I can tell a hawk from a handsaw. Well, that's a, Hell in a Handbasket. It sounds good, but it might as well be a hen basket. I mean, a lot of hand baskets are used to carry eggs, so... Hen basket.
And so
sure.
People, now, have you heard, is that something you've seen? Because I don't know that I've ever heard anybody say hell in a hen basket.
Well, I hadn't either. But when I came across this phrase on the internet, I Googled it, and there are thousands of usages of it. And it's clearly people use it.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense to them. Well, listen, we're going to take some phone calls now. If you would put those headphones on, you will actually hear what this listener, Mike in Durham, has to say. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Glad to be on the show.
Sure thing.
So, yeah, related to hell in a handbasket, my college roommate had a saying that he used purposefully, but we always thought was funny, and so we continued to use it. He would say, going to hell in a ham biscuit, which sounds a lot like handbasket, and we always just thought it was hilarious, and I still use that to this day. And people will they won't even bat an eye. It's like they think that maybe that's what it really is, or nobody even notices most of the time that I've said it that way. But it's still funny. I still think it's a funny way to say it.
It's great. Well, thank you, Mike. And I guess it gets to the point that you create some really funny images when you're deliberate about this, right? Or even if you're not, but obviously his friend was being playful with the language.
Well, I think that's one of the things that I enjoyed about it is I hear these things and pictures come to mind, and so I found myself doing drawings to go along with them. So, but I think a lot of them are just figurative expressions, and so we have expressions like on the lamb that we think, oh, well, there must be a lamb in there.
And I had an uncle who would love to make you think he just cursed, and you would do this double take, but he would say things like, yeah, we brought the whole fam damily. You go, wait a minute, and you look at him, he would mangle language like that all the time. He was kind of genius.
That was a spoonerism.
That's a spoonerism, I guess, yeah. But And I guess they're all sort of part of the family. And, well, this brings us to the other question about this, whether or not you believe that sort of language is something that starts out on Mount Olympus and then degenerates over time, which purists seem to think that somehow when words change, you know, there's something awful that's happened to the language. But you take a more the sort of the dynamic view of language.
Oh, sure. I mean, language changes. And there's this whole debate about whether you should be prescriptive or descriptive in sort of the way you approach language. Well, for instance, one of the phrases in the book is duct tape, right? Well, everybody knows what duct tape is, and they laugh at people when they use duct tape, quack, quack. Yeah. But actually, the word started out as duct tape.
What?
And cotton fabric known as duck, D-U-C-K, after the Dutch word. And then somebody came up with a bright idea of rubberizing it and putting stickum on it, and they used it for heating ducts, and so it was malapropped into duct tape. And now when somebody uses duct tape, they get laughed at. But there's actually a brand out there that's known as duct tape.
So it's actually kind of come full circus.
And in many cases it does. Like, for instance, one of them in the book is the flamingo dance. Well, guess what the word flamingo means in Spanish? I mean, flamenco means in Spanish is flamingo. So it's sort of come back to its original meaning.
Oh, it did.
Yeah.
So, well, what does that have to do with the dance? Do we know? How did that get
kind
of, or the song, the music itself, flamenco?
I suppose you look like a flamingo when you're dancing.
Apparently you do. Well, we said we were going to take some phone calls and your emails as well. Ed says that one that has taken root in his family's lexicon is from a nice lady who, facing a challenge, would say, well, I think I can coax with that.
I like that.
And she seems to, but you know, there again, there's a kind of a similarity, right? I mean, to coax is to sort of gently urge, and coping is that sense of sort of gently, you know, becoming, making it work for yourself, right?
Well, there's that. I think that's what the way it works is that you hear it in your head, and it makes perfect sense. The academics call this reanalysis. That's the academic term for it.
Reanalysis. This would be
reanalysis, right?
Look at your end.
I think I'm going to have to do another volume of this.
So we talked about some of these. Oh, bated breath. Now, this one fooled me because while it never made sense to me that one would wait with bated breath, because who wants to meet you when I encounter you with worms in your mouth? But you tell me that it was never bated breath, or not originally.
Well, maybe if you're a fisherman, you have bated breath. But it's abated. It's from Shakespeare, actually. And it means to abate, to hold back your breath, to sort of he's waiting with his breath held. And that makes sense in that term, but not all that many people know the Shakespeare play, and they've just heard it for hundreds of years, and makes perfect sense to them, bated breath.
We are talking about malapropisms today on The State of Things. Robert Alden Rubin is my guest. He teaches at Meredith College in Raleigh, and he's written a book that puts together many of the modern malapropisms. And, of course, a couple of them, by the way, listeners to this program are familiar with two institutions that are part of your book. Malaprops, of course, the bookstore in Asheville, and the Irregardless Cafe in Raleigh. Irregardless is one of the words that you deal with as well.
Sure. Is it irregardless, or is it regardless, or is it irrespective? And I think that just gets put together and in the case of the cafe, it makes perfect sense and perfect nonsense, and you get a perfectly good meal.
Well, you know, Arthur Gordon, who's the founder of the Irregardless, tells a story about his aunt who used to say that all the time, and they kind of knew that it really should be regardless, that it was not necessary to call it Irregardless. Just found it delightful, and so that's how he named. And Arthur, if I'm wrong, you know, I apologize, but it's a great story. Stick with it.
Well, people just love playing with words. I mean, I'm a perfect example. I'm the guy in the office, and I used to be a book editor, and I'm the guy who would propose a book on the history of spaghetti and want to call it Pasta, Present, and Future.
So, what about do you know anything about like Get the Hell Out of Here? Kind of a strange phrase, or doing a 360. Those things are not necessarily malapropisms. Those are phrases. I mean, I think this is part of what you get into, is we think about language itself and how weird it is, so that spoonerisms and malapropisms and word origins, you know, dead as a doornail. I'm like, how dead does a doornail get? That's not what you're doing here in the malapropisms.
Well, for instance, I'm interested in these sort of substitutions, like you mentioned dead as a doornail. One of them in the book is death nail. All right.
Instead of death knell.
Death knell. A knell is a ringing bell. But when you think about it, you nail somebody's coffin shut. Those are death nails, I guess.
Yeah, right.
So it makes sense.
Do we have – let me just to try to get one more on the air. Calvin is on the line from Killdevil Hills. I think we have time, Calvin, but it's got to be quick. How are you and what do you have for us?
Yes, nonplussed. It seems to have moved 180 degrees from its original meaning.
Nonplussed. My favorite. Thanks, Calvin. Yeah. Yeah, it's nonplussed, which doesn't – nonplussed, when people say he was nonplussed, they think what you're saying is he was confused. Nonplussed sounds like it means he was confused because it sounds like perplexed. In fact, nonplussed means unaffected, very calm, ambivalent toward. It's one of those really weird – it's one of those awful words, actually. It just doesn't sound like what it means.
Well, nothing more, I guess, is what it comes from.
Yeah, it's like so there are a lot of strange words like that. So what's your favorite? And the whole loggerheads is also another one.
Yeah, I like that one because I had to do a little detective work on that one. And I think it probably comes from ancient days of whaling. But the malapropism is this lager like beer, right? So you people say, oh, well, I have a glass of lager here. It has a head on it. Loggerheads.
How many angels can swim on the loggerheads of a beer?
Right.
It's the question we'll ask next time when Robert Rubin joins us, an English professor at Meredith College. The new book is called Going to Hell in a Henbasket, an illustrated dictionary of modern malapropisms. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
And you can find out more about that show and the book and everything we've talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. And in the news, Kevin McCarthy has withdrawn from the speaker's race in the U.S. House of Representatives. So the vote on replacing John Boehner has been postponed. That is surprising news. And you will hear all the details on this station and elsewhere on NPR later today. Meanwhile, I will tell you the State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai, as well as Robin Copley, who's our technical director, and Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.